everybody. Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and produced by members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and questioning communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Greer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight, our guest is Abby Lynn Bogomoni. Abby loves poetry for its ability to make the invisible real. As professor of English at Santa Rosa Junior College for many years, she had multiple opportunities to share her enthusiasm for language with students.
Abby is also known as editor of the anthology New to North America, writing by U.S. immigrants, their children, and grandchildren. She's the author of three poetry collections, Nauseous in Paradise, Black of Moonlit Sea, and People Who Do Not Exist. In the 90s, Abby's kind of smiling right now. It's cute. We would like to talk about those titles, especially People Who Do Not Exist. That's a very interesting title. In the 90s, she founded a poetry press, Burning Bush Publications, which offered an annual poetry prize. Tonight, she's here to talk and share poetry from her newest work, a chapbook, The Lighted Pole of Dreams. Welcome, Abby. How you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you on as our guest.
For sure. We are really looking forward to speaking with Abby in more detail and learning about her life. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer, Greg Maralia.
I love to change the world.
This is Greg Maralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of August 4th, 2024. Well, if you've been watching the Olympics happening in Paris, you may not know that there are 193 out gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, and non-binary athletes competing in the Games this summer. That includes more men than ever. According to Out Sports, this number, which is expected only to grow, surpasses the 186 out athletes that competed in the Tokyo Summer Olympics back in 2021. And it's nearly four times the number of 53 that competed in Rio back in 2016. This list is dominated by women by about a ratio of 9-1, which is similar to Tokyo. However, it does include 20 out gay and bi men, which is a record. On the list are the first out gay male U.S. men's track and field athlete Nico Young and Timo Kablias from Germany. This record number reflects the increasing visibility and acceptance of LGBTQ plus athletes. However, this is primarily a phenomenon of countries in North and South America, Western Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. So far, 27 nations represented within Team LGBTQ in Paris, from a total of 206 teams currently competing. Team USA does have the most out Olympians with 32, followed by Brazil with 30. And in Texas, a gay man in Austin was walking to his Uber late at night earlier this week when a group of men suddenly assaulted him, shouting an anti-gay slur as they beat him. The Austin Police Department is currently investigating the case as a hate crime. Three University of Texas Delta Sigma Phi fraternity members have been arrested following the attack after they turned themselves in. There is an arrest warrant out for an additional woman who is believed to have participated in the attack. In Texas, it is notoriously hard to prosecute hate crimes. Of the over 6,000 crimes that have been listed by the state's police as occurring since 2001, only 41 have actually been charged as hate crimes, and the majority of them don't even make it to court, as prosecutors rarely pursue actual hate crime charges. LGBTQ activists and lawmakers have tried to combat this lack of enforcement. Equality Texas Executive Director Ricardo Martinez told station KXAN, quote, "We need lawmakers to have the courage to stand up and do something meaningful to protect our community, because violence like what happened to this last victim falls squarely on their heads," end quote. And Pride Month may be over, but there's still a lot of victories for the LGBTQ plus community to celebrate. Out of the over 550 anti-LGBTQ plus bills introduced last year, only 80 of them were passed into law. So far in 2024, just 41 of the 527 anti-LGBTQ plus bills introduced have been passed and signed into law. And while those numbers may still seem daunting, it's important to note the low success rate of legislators attempting to pass these laws, or rather, the high success rate of the queer activists working to block them. Furthermore, there are several states that have passed laws protecting LGBTQ+ rights in education and health so far this year. For example, in Washington and Minnesota, both states voted to enact inclusive curriculum laws covering LGBTQ+ history and identity. And in the state of Colorado, the state approved protections for LGBTQ+ students, ensuring their identities will be validated and not shared without their permission. In the states of Maine, Maryland, and Rhode Island, laws have been passed to protect youth access to gender-affirming care. There is a clear divide, however, in the U.S., as it's largely blue states passing legislation to protect LGBTQ+ people, and in red states where laws are being passed generally to restrict queer rights. But don't let any of this good news take away anything from the importance of this upcoming November's election. Here in California, voters will be asked again about marriage equality, this time with Proposition 3. If enough yes votes are cast, the discriminatory language restricting marriage to only one man and one woman, currently enshrined in our state's constitution back in 2008, will be removed. A yes vote on Proposition 3 supports marriage equality and will protect it from an adverse action by the U.S. Supreme Court. And finally, don't forget, registration is currently underway at Napa Valley College for the Introduction to LGBT Studies class that will be meeting on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 11 a.m. starting on August 27th. This course is part of the LGBT Studies degree program as well as three other different certificates. There are no prerequisites. The textbook is provided for free and everybody is invited to attend. You can learn more at napavalley.edu. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
We are talking with Abby Bogomolny, and again, Abby, we want to thank you for giving us a little bit of time from your very busy schedule.
My pleasure. It's an honor to be here.
So why don't you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about yourself, your hobbies, your passions, what you do for work, all that stuff.
Well, I have the privilege of being able to look back on my life now. I worked as an instructor, professor with many community colleges. The longest was Santa Rosa Junior College, and I still do work for the college doing one-to-one work with students. And that is a joy because I get to share my knowledge and my enthusiasm for the written word and poetry and other literature. Oh, I love that. But I'd say my life has been about creativity, about bringing what's inside of me and envisioning how to make the world better and bringing out more positivity in people and equality. So my first love is music and literature and poetry, but I also do a great deal of photography and love the visual. So that's pretty much what I've been doing. I do dabble a bit in the invisible, but that's a whole other conversation.
How did you start? I mean, where did this passion come from?
Well, I grew up as an only child. And so without siblings, I didn't have that kind of company, if you will. So there were the parental units and myself. And I had to fill that with something. And I was very sensitive. And I'd always pick things up that would be in the room. I think all children do. And I had to do something with that. I used to draw. I used to make little books when I was a child. I remember writing a letter to God. And when my parents allowed me to go up on the roof occasionally, I took that letter and I threw it off the rooftop, figuring, well, how do you give a letter to God? I don't know. You can't mail it. So I figured, well, let's just throw it out in the wind, you know? So I did that. I grew up in Brooklyn, New York. It was an urban area. Flatbush was the neighborhood. Went to Erasmus Hall High School. It's kind of a famous one where a lot of musicians and folks in literature went, and attended Brooklyn College in New York as well, until I traveled.
That's a beautiful image, though, the on the roof. I'm just really stuck with that. I haven't heard that one before, Abby. That's beautiful. Have you written anything about throwing letters to God? I mean, it's just beautiful.
Sometimes I'll include it in an introduction about myself. You know, as a child, she began writing and threw notes off the roof as letters to God, you know, so occasionally, but no one has really commented on it.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, did God ever respond?
Well, not on paper, but one thing about writers, we become very sensitive to all of the thoughts in our own head. And some of those thoughts may not be our own thoughts. We could be picking them up. It could be other people speaking. I'm not talking about any kind of clinical abnormality. It's more of an awareness of the various contradictions that exist within all of us. And so, oh, gee, I want to go to the party. Oh, no, you want to stay home. Oh, no, I really want to get out. I'm so bored of looking at this room. No, you're tired. You should stay home. So what writers often do is we externalize the various voices, you know, the cognitive dissonance that all of us have, and to put that on paper and create actual characters that embody those different points of view, you have drama. You have this beautiful personal drama being passed off as a real drama between separate individuals. And that's a secret that many writers in theater, writers who write screenplays, they do. It's their whole drama that's inside their own little head put on the stage. So as a child, I picked those things up from outside and inside and began to entertain myself, the seen and the unseen. Also, I love music and love rhythm, and language to me always has rhythm. Different languages have a slightly different meter and a slightly different melody and rhythm. So I take English and I try to push it. You know, I try to push it to be sometimes, you know, different than how it usually rolls out. But if you listen to people speaking, depending on where they're from and their regional accent and the pitch and rhythm of their language, it's just fascinating. You know, someone from Los Angeles, you know, very different than someone from Manhattan or someone from Texas. It's just fabulous, you know, and that gets into my writing.
Can you give an example?
I have a poem in an exhibit called Reverberations at Sebastopol Center for the Arts, and it's an ekrastic poem that's paired with a sculpture. Ekrastic poetry is poetry that responds to visual art, to painting or sculpture. So this illustrates how someone that has a very different dialect than what I usually write, and it's a poem that pairs with Ramakan O.R. Worcester's sculpture, What Was Done. Pad me nice, reel me round, root, heal me. Bandage conceals what was, oh, pressed me sure a shanty, broke what could, what old time would, till shouting kept me breathing. Orange cloth, cotton soft, coil me satin silk, weave me tight to no longer totter or feel broken days. Crochet me full and my pearl will shine. Sweet butter biscuit, rag rug time, left and loose shows me how to roll my gown just so. See how healing feels as love becomes me. So that's a different kind of dialect than what we have. Another poem. I said to poetry, shut up. Why do you choose the exact moment I carry dishes of spaghetti to speak to me? Why do you roll out waves of words when my best friend Phyllis needs undivided attention? There's a whole different dialect happening in these two.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Where's the sculpture again and your poem? And can people go see that?
Oh, yes. It's Sebastopol Center for the Arts on High Street in Sebastopol. And the exhibition is gorgeous. Lots of paintings and visual art that all have poetry attached to give the viewer another layer to work with as they see the amazing work. Let's see. So it's running, I believe it's running through the beginning of August. I think it's August 10th.
Well, thank you for that.
Yes, I'm excited. I would like to see that. That's beautiful.
You read a poem and the one line that's sticking out for me is why, I think you're speaking to the words, why are you coming forth when I have a plate full of spaghetti? That was really a beautiful image. I can see that right now. Can you talk a little bit about how you got that line? I don't mean to be nitpicking, but it was just so interesting.
You know, the rest of the poem follows that trajectory. It's a poem to poetry. I said to poetry, poetry, each time you lift me like a party balloon, it takes me hours to find my balance. when you transport me to planets that swirl magnetic seas of unbelievable colors, how can you expect me to remember a counseling appointment? No more of your distractions. I have to live here. Again, it's a drama. It's a speaking back to someone as if poetry's, you know, I'm personifying. We call that personification in literature. You know, you're making something that alive that is normally we don't consider it to be a being.
Like, yeah, like a relationship. Like you, yeah, this dialogue between you and poetry. Yeah. It's cool.
If you're in a conversation, you might say, words flew through the air between us. When you give agency to things that are inanimate, normally we've seen them as inanimate, the words have this energy.
I can feel your enthusiasm, Abby, in your body, the way it's moving. Our listeners can't see that, but it feels powerful. It feels like, yeah, big joy.
Mm-hmm. So Abby, you said you love music and rhythm, and you are quite a percussionist. You are quite a drummer. How does drumming influence your poetry? How does poetry influence your drumming or any other type of music you sing? How does that weave in and out?
I think you said it best in terms of weaving in and out. They weave. I do have a poem where I play with the drum, and you know, I'm doing a 6/8 on the drum for brief periods, and then, you know, I'm speaking the poem at the same time. So, but it doesn't have a melody, it is spoken word with the drum. And I have to say I was influenced by not just the beat generation, but the very early, the Black Arts Movement, and specifically the Last Poets in the early 1970s, who had spoken word over, you know, a whole battery of congas. And it was really incredible. And I went, wow, this is another way. This is another expression, another way other than sitting with my guitar and writing nice lyrical songs, you know. So I did that too. I was a songwriter back in the day as a teenager. My last year in high school, some young people from NYU who had gotten a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation came to our high school, and they knew that there was a theater company of folks that were very talented. And I was in this theater company. Erasmus has a play every year called Sing, S-I-N-G, Sing, and the different grades compete with each other. So they wanted to meet with us, and they watched what we do, and they got to know us a little bit. And then they chose about 10 of us to be in the summer company of the New York Free Theater. And the New York Free Theater was funded from grants through NYU. And we wrote songs and performed on the street as street theater with permits and, you know, all that. And it was my first job as a performer to be paid. Right when I graduated high school, it was incredible. That summer, it was amazing. Some of the folks in the company were Judith Castleberry and Jacqueline Dupree, Stephen Grossman, and many others. Those are the folks who recorded and have albums and, you know, worked as professional entertainers and songwriters. And Judith Castleberry is now a professor at Bodine in Maine and teaches Africana studies. That was quite an experience. And I guess I began as a songwriter. You know, but rhythm and language, it's like rhythm to poetry and rhythm to music is like oxygen to the body. You know, without oxygen, we can't do anything. Without that whole relationship of time and, you know, between utterances or notes on an instrument, it doesn't happen. This is like the physics of it, you know.
So you're singing. You play drums with your music, you sing, I mean, with your poetry, and you sing with your poetry. Maybe, is there something that you have that maybe you can give us a showing or listening?
Oh, yeah, that's sure. It's, I mean, I try to be normal and just read my poetry like everybody else. But at a certain point, it's like, okay, I'm getting tired of this, you know, it's like, we're just reading, and reading's great. I mean, language is fine, but it's so stripped down, you know, that it's like that. I mean, I could read this lyric, but singing it is so much It's so much more fun. So I was influenced by the lyrical poets and what they call the romantic poets, like Percy Bysshe Shelley and others of his time. Some of this went out of style with end rhymes and perfect rhymes, but for songwriting, it's still the way to go. Though I tend to use a lot of half rhymes. I could read part of this and then sing, and you'll see the difference. So this is Of the Light. We live in someone else's house, wide doors and window screens. Though we hurl ourselves against the light, escapes beyond our means. From the wide cave of her belly, we came to forage fruits of the sun, till strength moves us to challenge the night with tremulous deeds of our own. Or I could sing it. We live in someone else's house, wide doors and window screens. Though we hurl ourselves against the light, escapes beyond our means. From the wide cave of her belly, we came to forage fruits of the sun, till strength moves us to challenge the night with tremulous deeds of our own. That's a sample.
Two versions of the same. Beautiful.
Yeah, there's a bridge and da da da, then it resolves. So
Well, why did you stop?
I don't know.
She's giving us a taste.
don't know. Yeah, getting a little taste, But one friend of mine who looked at one, I have a I'm in a poetry group where we meet and share and do gentle critique and support each other. And she read my new chapbook, The Light of Pool of Dreams, and she said to me, "Abby, I had no idea it was going to be about your life, or that it was really about like a narrative." And that really surprised me because I didn't intend it to be a narrative, but when I look at it, there is a story behind each piece, and the way they fit together is a sequence, like a narrative.
Where can people get this chat book?
Well, this is available at all online booksellers, Barnes and Noble, Amazon, or online from the publisher at finishinglinepress.com.
So, Abby, you talked about the narrative of your life, right? So, in the book, is there an introduction that speaks to that? How will just any reader know that?
They're not going to know it unless they get it.
Okay. Okay.
Your colleague knows it because she knows you.
When a poet uses I, that doesn't always mean that I is the poet. Occasionally, there's poetic license, or we're writing poems from somebody else's point of view. And so you can't always assume that I is the poet. However, when there are little pieces that fit together logically that way, you can deduce that.
That's an interesting point, the I, because I write poetry as well, you know. And my editor here sometimes talks to me about I versus you. It's just interesting because sometimes I want to write I because my work is about empowering others to read, right? And to empower them. So I want to get your take on that part of the I because it's not about me. It's about me trying to empower someone else. I am powerful. I am strong, or whatever the words may be, you know? So, do you come across that, or is that an issue for you when you use the I and you're trying to give a message?
In response, there's a very famous poem by Archibald MacLeish called Ars Poetica that has a nice comment that helps answer the question you posed. And Ars Poetica means the art of poetry. A poem should be palpable and mute as a globed fruit, dumb as old medallions to the thumb, silent as the sleeve-worn stone of casement ledges where moss has grown. A poem should be wordless as the flight of birds. A poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs, leaving as the moon releases, twig by twig, the night-entangled trees, leaving as the moon behind the winter leaves. memory by memory, the mind, a poem should be motionless in time as the moon climbs. A poem should be equal to, not true, for all the history of grief, an empty doorway and a maple leaf. For love, the leaning grasses and two lights above the sea. A poetry should not mean, but be. So I read this because this is MacLeish's opinion about what good poetry should do and should be. When it says a poem should not mean, but be, poetry speaks in the language of metaphors and the language of symbolism. So metaphors and symbolism teach us much better, they influence much better than sometimes a direct statement of I or you or we tell. If we tell, if we say, he looks disheveled, okay, or he looks very sloppy today, you know, they were telling. But if we say, he walked into the room looking like an unmade bed, then we're showing. And so often, I think listeners and readers, they don't want to be told. They want to experience. So it's our job to give them sights and sounds and smells and tastes of things that they have experienced in their life. And there are associations that they get from them. And we use that packet of knowledge that all people have to give them an experience to package what we want to say. So that's a roundabout answer to your question, but you know, that's the soul of literature. Of course, there are times when a direct statement is necessary, but the poem goes too far into those direct statements. People go, yeah, you know, I'm going to go do something else, you know, because we're tired of being told. Everybody's trying to talk, you know, everybody, you know, buy this, buy that, do that, do this. We're just like, leave us alone, you know, but give us, for all the history of grief, an empty doorway and a maple leaf. Wow. You know, to me, that blows me away, because what are you going to do with all that pain? You know, it's like you have to just give them an image, you know, an empty doorway. Wow.
And I'm still remembering your example of walking in the room looking like an unmade bed. Wow, mm-hmm. What a wonderful example. So it's time for our music break. We can't wait to get back to you and find out more about your life, Abby. I mean, what a wonderful person you are. You brought a beautiful song with you this evening. I'm wondering if you would introduce it and tell us a little bit about the song, and then we'll play the song.
Okay. I really love Yasmin Levy. She's a foremost, I won't call her a musicologist or a scholar. Her father was the scholar who resurrected Ladino. And so she sings in Ladino, and it's beautiful. That's about all I'll say.
Could you define Ladino for folks who might not know?
Yeah, Ladino is a mixed language, which is a combination of older Spanish, Spanish from around 13th, 14th century, mixed with Hebrew. And it's the language that the Jews of Spain spoke before they were expelled from the Iberian Peninsula.
Wonderful. And what is the name of the song again?
Irme Quero.
All right. Enjoy, everyone. Irme Quero by Yasmin Levy. And we will see you on the other side.
Irme Quero, madre. Ay, Yerushalay. Como me verde sus frutos, verde sus aguas. Y en él me arrimo yo. Y en el Señor una fragua nado con una piedras preciosas y lo está en el labrado con una piedras preciosas.
Was a beautiful song by Yasmin Levy, Ir Me Quero. Thank you so much for bringing it. What is she singing about in this song?
This is a song of reverence for, I guess, what we would call God and the highest of the high, the Great Spirit, the perspective of her ancestors.
Very beautiful. Thank you for turning me on to her. Wow. Now we're going to get into a little bit about your own personal life, Abby, and your life experiences coming out, how your life experiences have informed your writing, your poetry. So could you give us a little snippet of who you are and in a more sensitive way in your life?
What I can share with you is more of an experience than who I am, you know. So I think who we are, you know, what we all are is much bigger than any one experience. But in terms of this program and our audience, I think that not everybody has had the same experience. Oh, wow, you're gay. Yay. Let's go to the Pride Parade. You know, that we have many folks who are older or, you know, this is a very, you know, multicultural and diverse country we live in. People have different religions and different, you know, levels of practicing those religions. And not everybody says to their son or daughter, you know, oh my God, you're what? You know, not everybody says yay. Some people get really upset. Also, I'm a little older than young people today. So when I was in my teens, around 19 or 20, you know, basically, you know, coming of age time of my life. And when I realized, wow, You know, I'm different. I'm different. And this was the time when androgyny was really part of the culture. It was the late 60s, early 70s, and androgyny was big, and in a way that got us all off the hook. You know, we didn't have to walk around in dresses and high heels, right? We could wear jeans, we could wear sneakers, everything was cool. Guys had long hair, you know, women had short hair, you know, it was all cool. You could be who you wanted to be. So that was great cover for coming out. So that wasn't an issue. But my father was the age of a grandparent. I was born when he was in his mid-40s, and my mother was in her mid-30s. So they were a little older than the typical parents of the 1950s. My father was born in 1907, and that'll give you like a wake-up call about what his education might be. My family was not religious at all. But my father and his family had pretty strong opinions of what was right and wrong. And so being queer was just wrong. It was just wrong. And there was absolutely no way that he would accept it. My mother was a little bit better about it, but she had her own issues and she had to support my father. My mother had a great deal of illness in her life. And so that prevented her from having a career and working. And so she was, you know, like many women at that time, very dependent on my father in every way. So they were a block. And again, as an only child, I had one thing in my favor was I was the only child. There was no way they were going to disown me, but that didn't mean they'd give me an easy ride. And so my decision when I knew that I was different was not to come out to them. Absolutely not. I was going to like keep that in the closet as long as possible. I tried to move out when I was 19, and that's what I did. But right a year or so after I moved out, and I had just graduated college, I went back home, and my mother said to me, "I'm really worried about you. Are you a lesbian?" And I'm like, "Well, why are you asking me this?" She goes, "Well, you know, this girl is calling you like every day, and you're getting letters, and, you know, this is not normal." And I'm going, "Well, mom, she's a really good friend, you know." And she says, "Oh, no, I don't think so." She says, "I found this piece of paper." And she showed me a love poem that I had written. And she'd go, "What is this? Who did you write this to?" And I said, "Oh, it's just imagination, you know, it's really not to anybody." And she says, "I don't believe that." She says, "You have to tell me. You have to tell me. I need to know." And I'm like, "I'm not going to say anything, mom. I'm not going to tell you." She said, "Oh, you have something to tell? So it's true. It's true." And she literally backed me into a corner of the living room, you know. And my mother was, you know, a giant 4'10", you know, but still it was the emotional intensity of that moment. It's like, "Oh, so you have something to tell? You mean it's really true? I'm not going to let you out of this corner until you tell me." You know, it's like, "Leave me alone. Just leave me alone. It's true. Okay. It's true." She goes, "Oh my God, this is going to kill your father." You know, and so it was high drama. She did tell my father. And then I was staying temporarily with my parents since I had just given up my apartment and going to the next adventure in my life after graduating college. And my father went to pray on the graves of his parents after learning this, you know, and he made sure that when he came back from doing so, he let me know that that's what he did. And I could tell it was rough. Within a day, I was running 103 fever. I'm serious. I got so sick staying there. So I called a friend and who lived in Manhattan, and she said to me, "Abby, you have to leave there. You have to pack a bag and you have to leave. Come stay with us." And I did, and I left. So my parents pretty much said to me, "We love you. We'll always love you. But don't worry, we'll get through this. We can have you fixed. We can have you fixed. We can send you to somebody who will help you." You know, so, and I said, "Well, I really feel fine. I think you need to go to talk to somebody about this." You know, I mean, that was, I said, "I mean, you're the ones who have the problem. I like who I am. You know, I like who I am. I'm supported. It is a different society. It's a different society now. There's nothing wrong." So they proceeded to give me all these negative statements about what it means to be gay from their perspective. And they knew gay people. My mother knew gay people in her life, and they were primarily tragic because of the time. But the world was changing, although the early 70s was still, very locked down, although, PFLAG was just being formed in 1976, and this was 1974. So it was 2 years before that. Anyway, to show it in my poetry, this is a small snippet of how it felt. Okay, it's not literal, it's how it feels to go through that experience. Events may send one down the chute narrow of metallic cold where sides close in as it tunnels below, to be spat into a sap-sucking slot, a cement corridor's dimly lit, a jagged space in which to stretch, breathe and pull ourselves to sleep. Deprivation spawns habits that gnaw at our core till we scream at others not to weep. And then another one. This is the lightless hour. Maybe it is the lightless hour that allows us to drift freely this way. The night without edges and moonlight is before us. We can escape like smoke through the window. Let us go. Let us go. In only a few minutes, they may come for us. So I guess what I want to say is that in terms of coming out or being outed, if you will, when you're not ready to do that, or if you're facing that and you're only 20 years old or 19 or 21, that's an incredibly important time of your life where, you know, you're full of energy. You might be in love with somebody and it's beautiful. You want to be encouraged in your life to follow your path, to find what you want to do with your life. That kind of negativity, that when someone doesn't support you in one of the most important human relations you're going to form in your life, of loving somebody, when they don't support you, where they throw, you know, all this negativity on something that's inherently so beautiful, is a big burden to carry. And many people self-destruct, many people hurt themselves because they feel that they're not worthy or that they're wrong, or how could they do this to these people who have given them everything? You know, someone who raised you gives you everything if they're good parents. My parents were good parents. They gave me everything. How could I do this to them? And so many people hurt themselves in various ways, but I didn't want to hurt myself. I wanted to somehow escape. I said, I need to survive this. And so my answer was to separate myself from them with distance. And it wasn't long before I left the New York metropolitan area. I ended up in Florida. I ended up down south with friends in a wonderfully supportive lesbian community that fed me where I could grow. And I basically had to say to my parents, who continued, we continued having contact. There was never no contact, but there was limited contact. I like to joke that if it weren't for the weather or how my car was running, we wouldn't have anything to talk about, because the typical phone call would be like, are you changing? Why aren't you changing? You know, you need to, you know, we don't, you know, we don't agree with the, what you're doing, you know. And I'm like, look, I have to ask you, I would say, I need to ask you this, to do this. If you don't have anything positive to say to me about my life, please don't call me. And I was only able to do that because I was an only child. There was no way my parents were going to cut me off. Other people who have, you know, they might be one of several siblings, they can't do that. And this is a real deep tragedy when parents, because of ideology, their belief and their ideology gets in the way of being able to love and encourage their children, you know, their sons and their daughters. So I was lucky by being an only child because I knew my parents would be there for me, and they told me that. But that blow to your self-esteem is really rough. So in terms of poetry, I literally had to leave and wrote a long poem called Saved that shows how warm this community was and how I landed in a place that would support me. So I can read a little of that.
Oh, that'd be great.
Please, please, yes.
So this is Saved. It's about the person who, in a way, reparented me. This friend of mine was a bit older than myself. And it's, you know, historically, this is not a new thing. Somebody older than you sees the pain you're in and they mentor you. So anyway, Saved. You're still cute as potato pie. Gray bangs falling over your brown eyes, alive and bright with a can-do grin. Years ago, you plucked me off the molten July streets of Manhattan and offered me shelter in a red farmhouse on a Florida hill. Orange groves on one side, pecan grove on the other. Behind it, a gentle slope through a field dotted with grazing horses to the fresh water of the lake. You were 35 that day I landed. I saw flip-flops flapping at the end of your strong brown legs, saw two long brown braids that framed your grin. You became my unofficial official manager, protector, and model stargazing poet, writing a dissertation about the astrological influences bubbling through Henry David Thoreau's Walden. Your work, written from a second floor upstairs view of the fields, orchards and sky full of poetry, introduced me to doodle bugs in the grass, red bugs in the Spanish moss, and flying palmetto bugs you'd catch in paper bags. Your mom, a high school English teacher in Baton Rouge, drew me down to the lake we shared with cows, pulled me slow with your car down the road on roller skates. You wrung a lot of vowels out of each word. Let me bring my no good girlfriend down on Amtrak, who traveled with a paper bag of underwear and a vodka bottle. Took me to Palatka for food stamps. Told me to stay out of the kitchen and off the phone in lightning storms. Found me gigs as the acoustic singer-songwriter to draw gaggles of gals to the bar. Mabel's Blue Water Bay, Gainesville's Bilbo and Gandalf's, Monk's Inn, Jacksonville's Little Dude, and St. Augustine's Pagoda. Let me decorate the ground floor bathroom with palm fronds stapled to the walls. In the orange blossomed springtime, I learned what it was like to live inside of a perfume bottle. Every day, one of plenty. Your theater named the frothing slosh on your and your land down the road. Each week you held court in a living room with a jug of wine and a ring of women, one of which your current flame as your steady girlfriends slept upstairs. I was 21 and planned to stay 2 weeks, stayed 10 years.
Wow.
All I say is I was lucky. I was real lucky. And later on in life, I was able to help her publish a collection of her poetry. She was a professor at a community college as well. And funny how that worked out, but yeah.
What a blessing, right? What a blessing for you to meet her.
Yeah, and what I have to say is that the young person whose elders do not understand and don't support them in their choices of identity or orientation, you're being hurt. But as a young person, you have a responsibility to them as well. In other words, often there's anger at not being accepted. There's anger at not being supported. And so my challenge was realizing the limits of that anger. You know, that anger being thrown back at my parents would have been completely self-destructive, because that's a very important relationship in your life. You know, one's father, one's mother, etc., or brothers. I didn't have brothers and sisters, but still, that is your nuclear family, and to break with them completely is another way to self-destruct. You know, again, depending on who the folks are, of course. But my folks were good. They were good people, very good people. So I just want to say that the responsibility of the person being hurt still is to hold on to whatever shred is available, because the relationship is important. And when it came time later in life for when my father got ill, when my mother got ill, I had to say to myself, hey, they did the best they could with what they had, you know, and who, how they were educated. And, you know, now my mother is an elderly woman who's ill and sick, and I need to show up for her. And I showed up and she started right in again, you know, with the stuff. And I said, Mom, you know, I need to be here for you. You need to stop because I can't be here if you're going to do that. And she said, okay. You know, she said, okay, I won't. And at the end of her life, we actually reconciled. And she actually said, I feel so bad that we had a broken home. That's how she put it, you know. And I said, you weren't divorced. What, you didn't divorce, you know, my father. What are you talking about, broken home? She goes, no, you know, and she alluded to your father didn't approve. So, you know, so she, again, I got it, you know, I got it. And she literally apologized at the end of her life for the break that happened because they missed out, you know, they missed out on being able to be proud of me. And my mother once said to me when I had moved her to San Francisco to get the care she needed. And I came home, I came over there from teaching one day and I was dressed like a teacher. And she goes, oh, you look nice. You know, like she goes, who would think you would become this person the way you went? And that's sort of a direct quote, you know? In other words, so her association with being different in that way, you know, being queer, was so different than any modern day reality. But it took a while for her to get that, and she got it. She goes, oh, wow, you know, how could you become this person when you went this way in your life? She didn't, you know, and she got it. And I saw the realization, and I was so happy. Emotionally, this knot that I'd been carrying for like 30 years just relaxed. So that was powerful. That was a powerful thing. So there was, but if I had been, you know, the kind of person that just said, no, you don't get me, you know, forget it. I don't want anything to do with you either, you know, then there would have been that wall, you know, there would have been that wall. And that is tragic. Ideology goes both ways. I can't love you because you don't believe in what I believe. People's ideology stops love and stops togetherness. If there is a message to my poetry, it's about love and growth and not giving up on each other, no matter what.
Beautiful. Abby, I'm just thinking about the woman that you were with for 10 years who supported you with the, what you just shared about the belief in the ideology of what, how we feel and think about things. Did she have any influence in helping you stay grounded in that respect of your parents and sticking by them in a way?
Well, her family was from Alabama, and she had a brother who had, I still don't know what he had, but he was not a functioning individual. So there was already in the family this ability to love each other no matter what. So I guess I did get that through osmosis, you know. And the thing about the South is it's a pretty crazy place in many ways. There's a lot of contradictions and a lot of harshness. Her first thing was to keep me alive, because being a person with a New York accent who wasn't sensitive to how to act in the South, the rural South, this is North Florida, almost real close to Georgia. It's not a real friendly place to outsiders. And I was definitely an outsider. And there were places that I really shouldn't go, you know, shouldn't go. There are lakes and places where, no, don't go walk there, you know. And so she shared the rules with me of the South. But I think I got through osmosis, you know, I learned through osmosis with her. An example more than anything.
Abby, do you have one last poem you can share with us before we have to say goodbye?
I'll share the title poem of the book. kind of inspired. I wrote it when I lived in Santa Cruz, so it has a reference to the hill. The hill is the Santa Cruz Mountains, so and this is called The Lighted Pool of Dreams. Inky black of moonlit sea, our walk at midnight by the lighthouse, bundled warm from the cold after a dim day of rain in housebound January. Other nights, I fly over the hill where mist lingers in silver patches, breathe the airborne fog. On the return, a fringe of redwood fingers brushes my gleaming belly. Outstretched wings glide me. I am pulled by the sureness of gravity and my love of returning to you. With the turning earth, so do we. Half in waking, the other half sleep. We fall inside, unwind, and retreat. As green things twist an inch by inch daily toward the sun, we drift closer to the lighted pool of dreams. Invisible to eyes outside, we fall, fill ourselves, and fly. Flapping and feeding, we flock like seagulls to the lighted pool of dreams.
Wow, this has been such a pleasure to be with you, Abby. So, for the listeners, could you please tell us again your dates of your readings?
Oh, yeah, I have a couple coming up. Actually, one is tomorrow evening, Monday, August 5th. And I'm part of the Rivertown Poets group that reads at Aquas Cafe. Many people are. It's not just a couple. They feature poets every couple of months. And so it's August 5th from 6:15 to 8:30 at Aquas Cafe in Petaluma, 189 H Street. And it isn't just me reading. There are two features. So I'm a featured poet that evening, and so is Fred Carroll, a poet who's been writing for over 60 years. And Dave Seter, who's the new poet laureate of Sonoma County, will open the reading. I'm not sure if he what he will do or say. I'm sure he's gonna introduce some of his work to us. So it'll be myself, Fred Carroll, and Dave Seter that evening. So there's that. And one other reading coming up will be another book launch. It will be September 15th between 1 and 3:30, and it's scheduled for reading and book signing at a private home in Cotati. So I'm not giving out the address, but if you're interested, please message me or email me at Abby, ABBYB poetry at gmail.com. ABBPoetry@gmail.com, and I can give you directions.
Wow, thank you so much for taking your time to share yourself with us tonight, Abby. What a wonderful show. What a wonderful person. We want everyone to remember that just like Abby, you too can be living proof that through being visible and vibrant and perseverant and finding your niche, you can make this world a better world. This is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then,
Good
good night.
night.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. The Jazz Hot is next.